KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is December 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Firefighters are hoping today brings the last Santa Ana winds to the Woolsey Fire in Ventura and LA counties. The red flag warning expires this afternoon at 5. Fire officials say they're hopeful the wind will shift to an onshore direction by midday. Meanwhile, a body was found this morning in the fire area of Agoura Hills. No word yet on the cause of death or the identity. The bodies of two adults were found last week in a burned car off Mulholland. They've not been identified either. Nearly 6,000 firefighters continue to work Woolsey. Last night's dampness helped, along with decreased winds. The fire's 47% contained, with full containment expected Sunday. But what about the residents who've been out of their homes in many cases since early last Friday? Last night, the city of Malibu held a meeting for evacuees at Santa Monica High School. KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale was there. Emily, good to have you with us. I'm sure a lot of people very stressed out and frustrated they can't get back home.
Yeah, I mean, that was really kind of, that encapsulates the meeting. It was just frustration. There were a lot of people at this meeting today. The entire first floor of this auditorium at the Santa Monica High School was full of people. They actually had to let more people up into the upper levels. And the questions just kept coming from residents. When can I get home? You know, when can I see the damage to my homes? A lot of people I talked to don't actually know what's happened to their home. And you can only imagine that would be really frustrating. And, you know, there was a lot of law enforcement. There was a lot of fire enforcement there, but no one could really answer that question. And that really just, the tensions just bubbled over. People were kind of screaming from the audience. And, you know, I think people really wanted to leave with that question answered. And it really wasn't.
Well, as we've seen in some of the massive Northern California wildfires, in some cases, people have been out of their home for weeks because of what it takes in law enforcement to clear the area, to make sure it's safe, to deal with the potential looters, and to make sure that everybody's identified who comes back into the area. I know that's no solace for the Malibu residents, but this is not uncommon for large-scale fire areas to take a long time to repopulate.
Absolutely. Actually, the superintendent of the Santa Monica Malibu School District was there, Ben Drotti, and he did say that, you know, in Santa Barbara, for example, it took them, you know, over 2 months to even go back to school. And of course, all the Malibu schools are closed right now. He says he's expecting schools to open. They're hoping November 26th, but again, that's just up in the air. So there was a lot of talk comparing this fire to other ones and saying, you know, it's just going to take some time.
Let's bring into the conversation with KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale, Rick Mullen, the mayor of Malibu. Mayor Mullen, thank you for joining us again.
My pleasure. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sure can. I know you were not at the meeting last night, but from the reports you've got, what's your sense of the biggest task the city has in answering these questions for residents?
Well, I was not able to be at the meeting, but I did get a little cell phone reception in front of Pepperdine, watched it on YouTube on my phone, and that is the biggest source of frustration for anybody out there, and it's completely understandable. If I was out there, whether my home had survived or whether my home had been destroyed, I would want to get back in, and I know people are chomping at the bit, straining at the bridle. They want to get in. I completely understand that, but this is a big event, and there's still potential danger going on. There's a lot of infrastructure damage. They've got some massive teams of people fixing the telephone poles, putting the electricity back in, getting the water back on, etc. And I understand, and you know, my intention is for anybody who's out there, as much as I have influence at all, I'm going to try to encourage the public safety professionals to let people in as quickly as possible. They are going to let in one of the neighborhoods, and it probably will start coming in incrementally to the ones least affected that have most of their services restored, and it'll start going piece by piece by piece. And when you get to the western part, I work for the fire department. I'm a captain of the fire department, and my particular jurisdiction, which is just in the hills above the city, was completely destroyed. 50% of the homes have been destroyed. So some areas are affected worse than others, and they will start letting everyone in incrementally. But I want to say to everybody that's out there, I understand. But just time for everybody to take a deep breath, help each other out. And I would say, in your actions and whether you're expressing your frustration or whatever you're doing, am I a part of the solution now, or am I, you know, contributing to some of the frustration, and am I being a liability, or am I being an asset to the equation? Everybody wants to be an exception. So I would just ask everybody to please be patient and understand it's a big event, very destructive, and we want everybody to come in commensurate with security and commensurate with safety, and we'll do it as soon as we possibly can.
You mentioned that people would probably be coming back in neighborhood by neighborhood, depending on the damage and what services are available. Looting, obviously a huge concern for residents, and whether their property is secured and who's going to be let in. Can you share with us anything about how law enforcement is going to deal with the repopulation and potential vulnerability that comes with that?
There are law enforcement checkpoints pretty much at every road and every neighborhood throughout this area. And I've driven through a lot of the city, and I'm very impressed with how much they have it under control at this point. So, you know, you can imagine if they just let open the floodgates and everybody come in, it's going to be a big problem. So it's much better for the actual residents themselves to have stricter controls on who they let in and when they let in. And I just ask everybody to please be patient. I know what it's like. I'm pushing for people to get in here as quickly as possible, using every part of my influence to be able to do it, but I'm not going to compromise the safety of the residents and the security of those neighborhoods. And we're going to do it as quickly as possible. There's been severe damage out in the infrastructure, and they're putting in the. I heard the Edison guy say they have already installed 100 telephone poles as of yesterday, and I've never seen so much equipment out there. It's almost like, you know, World War IV, and they've got so many teams out there restringing major electrical lines up and down Canaan and along PCH and everything. When I went up Encinal Canyon, pretty much every telephone pole had fallen down one way or another. When the incinerator fire went through, there were dead deer all over the place. It's a post-apocalyptic war zone in some of these places. So if you're on the outside and you're frustrated about getting in your house, just take a deep breath. Please be patient. There are a lot of very capable professionals doing what they can to get you back in as quickly as possible. And please just go with the city staff and follow their direction. Thank you for doing that.
For some of these areas that have been absolutely devastated, you mentioned areas up in the hills above the western part of Malibu where half the homes are destroyed, and I'm sure the infrastructure is devastated too. Have you given people sort of expectation of how many days or weeks this could be before they're able to actually come back?
Everybody wants to know exactly. They want a firm answer. And you know, when a fire is coming in, they want a firm answer. And should I stay or should I go? And will my house survive or will it not? We're in the no firm answer area. There is no firm answer. So I would say, be patient. We'll get you in as quickly as possible. I'm not going to throw out a date or a time or anything, because I don't want to throw out any false hopes. I just want everybody to take a deep breath, get comfortable, and listen to the news, and we will do everything we can to get you back in as quickly as we possibly can.
We're talking with the mayor of Malibu, Rick Mullen. Emily, one of the things I understand was talked about at the meeting, residents are very concerned about rain that's forecast for next week because, you know, we all know what's happened in other burn areas here in California where flooding's happened.
Yes, that was definitely a concern last night. And the city did say that they're actually going to relax their ban on plastic sandbags, and those will be available available at the fire department. So it looks like that's going to be a way that people are going to be able to fortify their property.
Mayor, is there any way to potentially in such short order get K-rails into some of the areas, or is that even a ridiculous idea with the few days we're talking about?
I would say nothing's ridiculous at all. And the fire department contacted me proactively well ahead of my even knowing that the weather was, that rain was on the way, about the sandbag thing. And it said, hey, we got, you know, 1,000 sandbags. We're ready to deploy them. We're going to give them out to all the stations, far in excess of what our normal allocation is. We already got sand on the way. We just need you to give us the green light on lifting the plastic sandbag restriction. I said, granted, execute that plan. So there, the fire department is well ahead of getting all of that stuff out there.
Okay.
We want to get people back in so they can take care of those things, because we don't want to have a bunch of mudslide problems also. So,
you know, all right,
moving from one catastrophe into potentially another one.
All right. Thank you, Mayor Rick Mullen. Thank you, Emily Elena Dugdale, KPCC reporter who was at last night's meeting, for joining us here on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you were wondering about whether there's a Woolsey Fire news briefing that we've had so far this week at 11 o'clock, not today. That's a good sign. Last night was favorable with the weather conditions. It was a damper evening, and the winds were less than what we've seen in the past. So that's a positive, and it looks like if the Santa Ana winds are able to reverse into an onshore flow as of midday today and the winds die down generally, things will be very positive for, you know, the ongoing progress in the Woolsey Fire. So we're very, very happy about that. Also, just want to remind you that our next Film Week screening is coming right up. It's on Sunday, December 2nd, and this time we're doing a special matinee, 1 in the afternoon. It's The Artist, the terrific silent film, Oscar winner of just a few years ago with Best Picture, and we'll be screening that at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, beautiful historic movie theater, just down the street from where the theatrical scenes from The Artist were shot at the Tower Theater on Broadway. We hope you'll join us. You can get your tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. Once again, Sunday, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, December 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, one of my favorites, The Artist, silent film, which was shot all here in Los Angeles, which is part of what we do with our Film Week screenings. I hope you'll join us for that event. Well, British Prime Minister Theresa May confirming that the cabinet is meeting today to consider a draft deal for the UK to separate itself from the EU, Brexit as it's known. They've reached a proposed agreement on the terms of withdrawal. Joining us to talk about it, political correspondent for the BBC, Rob Watson. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So what are the tentative terms here that are under discussion today?
Well, this bit is where it gets kind of technical. I should begin by saying that this is a truly momentous point in British politics, because after what might be called a sort of a phony war since Britain left, made the vote to leave the European Union in June of 2016, nothing much in some ways has happened. But this is it. This is the moment of truth where Theresa May has reached an outline deal with the European Union about the terms of Britain's departure. So there are two things here. So first of all, is a withdrawal, a divorce agreement, if you like, and that is a legally binding treaty. And that involves such things as how much money the UK owes the EU, what's going to happen to the status of EU nationals living here, UK nationals living abroad, and what to do about avoiding a border, a proper border in Northern Ireland, between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. The Irish Republic is staying in the EU, of course. What this doesn't do, it is set out the absolute and concrete, the future relationship between Britain and the European Union. So there's an awful lot of difficult stuff still to come. And I should add, there's absolutely no certainty whatsoever about Theresa May getting her plan through her cabinet, or indeed through, more widely, through Parliament.
And what are likely to be the biggest sticking points of getting this tentative deal passed?
In a way, the way I would put it is that all of it. That's going to sound odd. I mean, to put it in a sort of a general way, for those people in the governing Conservative Party who were on the leave side of the argument during the referendum, I mean, they just think that this is all going to leave Britain way too close to the European Union economically. Whereas those people who were on the Remain side of the argument, they also think this deal is rubbish and that it would be trash. It would be much better for Britain to stay in the European Union. And the big question, rather than getting too much into the weeds of why they feel that, the question, it seems to me, as to whether this really all comes horribly unglued, is whether people on the Brexit side think, you know what, this deal is not great, but at least we get to leave the European Union. And whether enough people on the Remain side think, we would much rather be staying in the EU, but we don't like the idea of the chaos that would follow leaving the European Union without any kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm. Where does this leave Northern Ireland? Because there's just, you know, so much every day that goes on with goods between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Now, if you're going to have, you know, this kind of a border compared to what happens now, where does that leave the island as a whole?
So in a funny sort of way, the issue of Northern Ireland is the problem of Brexit writ large, because those campaigning for Britain to leave the European Union, if you remember, anyone listening remembers, the slogan was take back control. We want to take back control of our borders, our laws and our money. Now, the problem, of course, is that the danger there is that, well, if you want to take back control of your borders, doesn't that mean one between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is staying part of the UK? And that is all inconsistent with the peace agreement, with the Good Friday peace agreement. So much of the last 2 years has been trying to figure out how on earth do you square that circle. And basically, the way it's been left is that essentially, unless and until Britain and the European Union reach an agreement about a super close free trade deal, their future relationship, and unless and until that happens, even after Brexit, Britain and Northern Ireland would stay in a customs union with the United States. But of course, there are plenty of politicians in Northern Ireland, those on the, I've described them as the Protestant pro-unionist party, who are also pro-Brexit. They're not very happy about all of this because they think that somehow, you know, Northern Ireland is going to be even more closely tied to the EU than the rest of the UK.
And my sense was that in Northern Ireland, there was less enthusiasm for Brexit than the rest of the UK. But is that accurate?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is why this is just so horrendously complex and why an awful lot of people who are on the Remain side are saying, you know, didn't we tell you that there could be all these problems about the unity of the United Kingdom? I mean, if you have a second, I'll briefly explain it.
Yeah.
So in Northern Ireland, the majority of people have voted to remain in the United Kingdom. But the largest Protestant party, the largest Protestant pro-union party, as it's called, is very, very pro-Brexit. So Theresa May finds herself, because she no longer has a majority in Parliament, she finds herself needing to be propped up by this party, which, while it's true that it doesn't want a border with the Irish Republic, these people are, you know, they're very, very pro-Brexit, and indeed they're in favour of hard Brexit. So it's part of what's caused so much trouble. So, you know, it sort of stirred up tensions again in Northern Ireland that had been sort of on the back burner. And, of course, it stirred things up with Scotland, because the majority of people in Scotland voted to remain in the European Union. So, you know, you just run out of the list of problems that Brexit has created, you know, in terms of the unity of the UK, the way in which people get on here. It sparked a kind of a culture war. Plus, you know, it has most businesses in the UK utterly petrified.
Well, and so if I'm understanding you correctly, the status quo would remain for Ireland in total, pending a free trade deal between the EU and the UK.
That's right. I mean, you got to understand. I mean, in many ways, what is so odd about Brexit is this is the first time, as far as I know, this is the first time anywhere in the world people have tried to make trade between their countries more difficult. Because everybody listening needs to understand, I mean, at the moment, the UK and, of course, Ireland are all part of the European Union. It's single market and customs union, which means that we all share the same regulation. So let's say you're a farmer in the Republic of Ireland, and you raise ducks. But actually, the ducks are sent over the border into Northern Ireland to be turned into duck pate. I mean, at the moment, there's absolutely no problem. But what Brexit is all about, I mean, even though the Brexiters don't often talk about it in this way, is if you think about it, it's how to make it's to be less close to the European Union. And that, of course, has thrown up all of these complexities.
If Theresa May is not able to get this through and it gets stopped along the way in the cabinet or it gets stopped in parliament, what's the alternative? Just go back to negotiating with EU negotiators?
I would say that if that happens, and there is, of course, a chance that, well, we would be in the most almighty crisis of modern times, one of the biggest political crises in Britain since the end of the Second World War. And I say that because the stakes are so high. The European Union is our biggest trading partner. I say that because the parties, Britain's two major parties, don't agree with each other, but they don't agree amongst themselves about what Britain's future relationships should be. So you would have the prospect of politics in disarray, a country out there, you know, deeply, deeply divided ever since the referendum. You would have businesses worried. I mean, this would be a major, major crisis.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, talking about these developments. Rob Watson, a momentous time, obviously, for the UK. Thank you for sharing with us where it stands.
Well, thank you. And I'm sorry if some of the answers were a bit long.
No, it was great. I feel like I understand much better. Political correspondent for the BBC, Rob Watson, joining us from London. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we're going to talk about an experimental program in Sacramento to pay gang members for not getting involved in violence. Like, let that bumper play a little bit. That's pretty funky. Thanks, Ethan. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We so appreciate you and all the ways you support what we do here at 89.3. A few cities in California have been experimenting with a program called Advance Peace. The idea is to reduce gun-related violence in communities where gangs have been a part of life, in some cases for multi-generations. The idea behind the program is to end the cycle of retaliation that you often see related to gang activity. The idea is to help young men in those communities who are most likely to be involved. In Sacramento, for example, you've got a person who's been in the program for 6 months, can become eligible for a stipend of up to $1,000 a month if they stay out of trouble as a part of that program. But some people are critical of that, say, well, you know, should you really be paying people for essentially abiding by the law and not attempting to kill someone else? Other people say, well, it's an effective way. It's a deterrent to violence. With us to talk about the program is Devon Bogan, who's chief executive officer of Advance Peace, which has been piloting the program in cities like Richmond in the Bay Area, and they're hoping to take it to Stockton as well. Devon, thank you for joining us.
Larry, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks. Share with us a little bit more about how the young people are chosen for the program and the kinds of ways the program tries to help them get their lives on track.
Certainly. So first and foremost, thanks for having me again. Advance Peace provides what we call the Peacemaker Fellowship for young men and sometimes women who are at the center of firearm hostilities in the urban neighborhoods that we're focused on. You know, we work to address gun violence that traditional law enforcement practices have had a difficulty curbing. So the fellowship is directed at violent actors or suspected violent actors whom otherwise avoid law enforcement's reach. Our approach is based on the belief that, you know, unless and until police can remove individuals who continue to shoot from the streets, they should be influenced, motivated, inspired toward ending their violent behaviors on their own. And so it's important for the public audience to know that most oftentimes communities and law enforcement officials have an idea, very clear idea about who's involved in gun violence in those cities. And so with law enforcement's direction, community's direction, and our own neighborhood change agents who facilitate street outreach work that we deploy in those communities impacted by gun violence, we began to identify the individuals who would best be served by the Peacemaker Fellowship. Now, this Peacemaker Fellowship, Larry, is an 18-month postgraduate school-like experience directed at these suspected firearm offenders. And over this 18-month period, fellows are provided with intensive daily contact and engagement multiple times per day from our staff and a team of trained, volunteer, credible messengers. So try to imagine being a fellow 18 months and every single day you're being engaged with positive, healthy instruction, information, and example multiple times a day.
All right.
Multiple people. Fellows are also provided a monthly allowance, which you referenced earlier, of up to $1,000 per month. That's after 6 months, and it's based on life map goal achievement. Each fellow with their support staff assigned to them creates a personalized individual life map that helps them achieve goals in areas such as education, employment, parenting, conflict resolution, anger management, trauma, et cetera, et cetera. So the life map milestone allowance, or stipend as it's often referenced, isn't about paying any individual for behaving good or stopping shooting. The life map allowance is based on these individuals achieving goals,
all right,
in the areas of their life that are important for them to be successful citizens within those neighborhoods.
We're talking to Devone Bogan, who's Chief Executive Officer of Advance Peace, which has been working to implement this program of helping the most at-risk young people in communities with significant gang problems and problems historically of retaliatory gun violence. Also with us is Angie Wolf of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, a nonprofit research organization, which studied the program that was undertaken in Richmond in the Bay Area back in 2015. Ms. Wolf, thank you for being with us. What did you find from the Richmond program?
Well, Larry, thank you for having us on today. We're really proud of this important work and our experience in evaluating the ONS folks' work in Richmond, I think, led to some really fruitful system change work that was happening there. During the period of the ONS intervention, there were substantial reductions in gun violence across Richmond. I acknowledge there were other programs that were also aiming at curbing some of this gun violence, but ONS is such a systemic delivery system for intervention for these young people. We do attribute much of the violence reduction to the work that was happening in the office of ONS. The fellows themselves experience lower levels of violence and law enforcement contact due to gun violence activity than they had previously. And they're alive. They survived experiences. You know, one of the sad goals around the original orientation of ONS was to keep these men alive. These individuals were the most likely to be killed in the next 6 months. And we had 94% of the fellows alive at the end of their intervention period.
Now, one of the things I'm just wondering from a research standpoint, we've in Los Angeles, for example, seen a dramatic decrease in the last few years in gang-related, gun-related deaths. So that's happened in Los Angeles. I think there'd been in a number of other cities a decrease in that. So have you been able to factor that in so you're not attributing to the program a decline in gun-related violence that's happening because of other factors elsewhere?
I would say yes to some degree. Kind of across the nation, gun violence is going down. That's certainly a contributor here. Richmond had other activities that they were doing that impacted the community level of gun violence. But our work directly with the fellows that were receiving the services indicated that they were learning new ways of being. They were starting to value safety above all other things and understanding that guns were not a pathway to that safety. So the changes in the individuals that were involved in the program, combined with a community-level decrease in violence, do lead us to suspect that this is a promising approach when we're dealing with high gun violence communities.
All right. Also, just real quickly, I wanted to ask, is there a self-selection process where the people perhaps who are least apt to commit violent acts are the ones entering the fellowship? Angie Wolf?
There is a pursuit. We know in most communities who the most violent offenders are. Devone and his team works with them on an ongoing basis and are nothing short of relentless in getting those folks to commit to participate in the program. They can always say no, and sometimes they say no for 6 months. But if an individual shows up on Devone's radar, their strategy is relentless recruitment, relentless
right.
Pulling them into the services, which is one of the things that makes it very unique.
I want to thank you so much. That's Angie Wolf. My thanks to Devon Bogan. It's Air Talk on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Hope you're having a terrific day. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. There had been a news briefing for the Woolsey fire schedule that was canceled, and that's good news. That means firefighters who have just been laying it out every day, their efforts have been extraordinary, that they've made a lot of progress last night. That's good. They're looking in the next hour or so. They thought that there may be an onshore movement of wind, even though the red flag warning goes till 5, and that might give further relief. So it's some good news right now. We're not totally out of the woods, so to speak, but a lot of progress on the Woolsey fire. Well, I want to talk politics now on Air Talk because we saw dramatic gains for Democrats across the country in the House of Representatives. Obviously, Democrats took the House majority. And by the way, Kevin McCarthy, the Central Valley, California Republican, was just elected by his party in the House as the minority leader. So he's the minority leader. It appears Nancy Pelosi, the front runner to become Speaker of the House, to return to that position. That means both of the party leaders in the House would be Californians if Nancy Pelosi returns to that position with the vote of her fellow Democrats. But a big change that we've seen is in Orange County, where just in the past 24 hours, Democrats have taken the lead in the two still undecided House seats in Orange County. In the 39th, which not only includes northern Orange County, but southern LA County and a little slice of San Bernardino County, Gil Cisneros. He has taken the lead in that race by 700, he is trailing by 700 votes. So just poised to potentially take the lead from young Kim. She's had the lead since, you know, for early returns came in election night. And then you go farther south in the county. Katie Porter, the Democratic challenger to Republican Mimi Walters, has taken a lead of just about 260 votes over Mimi Walters, the incumbent. So it looks as though those two remaining seats could well end up in Democratic hands, which is an extraordinary reversal. Earlier, we had Harley Reuter, the Democrat, unseat 30-year Republican Dana Rohrabacher in coastal Orange County with us to talk about this shift and what it means particularly for Republicans, where a stronghold for the party has been Orange County, is Tom Campbell, Chapman University professor of economics and law, former House member, former state legislative leader, and former director of California State Department of Finance. Professor Campbell, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So what does this mean if in fact, these two final House seats that are outstanding go Democratic? What does that mean for the future of the GOP in Orange County?
I think the Republican label is toxic in California, and that appears to have extended even into Orange County. And I believe this will remain as long as President Trump is the leader of the Republican Party. It was very difficult for Republican candidates to separate themselves from the image and the substance of the president as they attempted to win re-election. That will be even more so in 2020 when the president is actually on the ballot.
Do you think, just looking longer term down the road, it'd be hard to think of a Democratic president who'd be less popular, particularly in California, than President Trump. But I wonder, would it take someone of perhaps extreme, progressive views to re-energize Republicans in Orange County? It's hard for me to, looking at the demographic shift, think, what would possibly revive the party even post-Trump?
I come to the conclusion that it's even post President Trump, the label is very hard to defend, and that was so when I was in Congress. The first 5 minutes of a conversation with anyone who did not know my record would be, "I am a Republican, but," and then you'd go into points of distinction. For example, I've always been pro-choice. It's now been three statewide elections: 2018, 2014, 2010. When not a single Republican won statewide. Specific to Orange County, yes, a very left-wing Democratic candidate would be possible to re-energize the brand. But I think there's a better chance if there's a moderate, sensible Republican candidate. But in my view, that is not President Trump and would not be, assuming he wins the nomination in 2020. And so I think the best route is to try a third party, and at least in those districts where the demographics is such that you might be able to win three or four assembly districts, for example, or one state senate district.
Orange County has had what I think of as a couple major Republican factions, one of which is evangelical Christians who are social conservatives. I'm not saying all evangelical Christians are social, but those who are and have historically voted Republican. Orange County has been a center of social conservatism and Republicanism among evangelicals. Secondly, you've got the fiscal conservatives who aren't necessarily religiously conservative, but hold to sort of, Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, smaller size government, less government spending. And, where are those folks, in your view, Professor, going to go?
I think the second group, I might add to the characteristics of them, that don't spend money you don't have. That's really the substance of being a fiscal conservative, and President Trump has. We have a more than $1 trillion budget deficit this year, and under President Obama, we had 3 years with more than $1 trillion deficit.
And George W. Bush was a big spender.
George W. Bush, absolutely. And indeed, you have to go back to President Clinton and a Republican Congress who together were able to balance the budget. So I think that second group, those who are fiscally conservative, would be interested in the third party that I've been describing. A socially moderate, fiscally conservative party would certainly statewide be attractive. But if you identify particular areas where no party has a lock and where you would be able to target a specific candidate in our top two primary system, it's hard for an independent or a third-party candidate to make it to the finals. But if it's an open seat with five or six candidates running, it's very possible. As to the first group that you described, no, I don't think they would find a socially moderate, fiscally conservative party attractive if the social conservative issues are dominant in their minds.
We're talking with Tom Campbell, Chapman University professor. Also with us, Gustavo Arellano, a California columnist for the L.A. Times opinion section and a former columnist, the O.C. Weekly of Ask a Mexican, former editor of the O.C. Weekly as well. Gustavo, good morning.
Hola, Larry. Great to talk about Orange County again.
Yeah, you wrote the piece about, you know, essentially this is the death of the old Orange County. And how important historically do you see this move?
Oh, my Lord. This is one of the most epic things to ever happen in Orange County history. I mean, Orange County, the Republicans that came out of here, this is where the National Republican Party from Barry Goldwater on drew its strength to be able to create what we have the GOP of today. It was Goldwater. He lost, of course, but he energized that base that got Nixon into the White House. Then you had Reagan, W to a lesser extent. And so to now have the possibility of not a single congressperson represent Orange County, I still can't wrap my – even though, of course, my former colleagues and myself at the OC Weekly, we've been calling for this new Orange County for years and years and years, and we called it way before it was cool to call it. It's still like we don't know what to make of ourselves.
Yeah, it's still stunning, isn't it? I mean, it's hard for me in talking about Orange County issues. You know, I went to college in Orange County. It's just I still can't quite conceive of every House member being a Democrat in Orange County. It doesn't quite compute.
Yeah, but if ever there was a party to suffer such a humiliating defeat, no one deserved it better than the Orange County GOP. I mean, this is a party that had it in they had everything for decades, and they ruined it a long time ago by basically waging an anti-immigrant, anti-Mexican campaign on a county that has been majority minority since 2004. I mean, some of these issues we were talking about, and they're talking a decade ago, longer at this point. And the GOP just did not see it, did not see where the wind was turning. And here we are today. Although that said, you were talking about sort of the bases of the OCGOP historically. There's been a third base that's been rising in the past couple of years. That's Asian Americans. So the one group for the GOP that won, it has been Asian Americans. Asian Americans, they represent a majority on the five-member board of supervisors. You have American, Korean American, and Vietnamese American. You now have two assembly members who are of Asian American descent. The mayor of the largest city in Orange County, Harry Sidhu, he's Indian American. He's also Republican.
Hey, hold that thought, Gustavo. I need to take a break, but we'll come back. We'll continue with Gustavo Arellano. Also with us, Norberto Santana, the voice of OC to come. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're looking at the dramatic political swing in Orange County. It's been a center of the Republican Party, huge fundraising engine for the GOP. But with the two outstanding House races trending Democratic at this point, for the first time in modern history, Orange County could end up with no Republican member of the House. With us to talk about that, Tom Campbell, Chapman University professor, former Republican member of Congress, former Republican state legislator and director of the State Department of Finance in the Schwarzenegger administration. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the Los Angeles Times and former editor of the OC Weekly. And Norberto Santana, publisher of The Voice of OC, the news nonprofit in Orange County. Norberto, want to bring you into the conversation here. Your thoughts about, you know, what's going on here and the historic nature of this result.
Well, it's definitely a changing it's a changing scene here in Orange County. The GOP does not have the lock that it once did over the county's political life. I mean, as Reagan said, this is where good Republicans come to die, and apparently they did. At the same time, here it's a complex. It's complex. There are still some Republicans that are being reelected. Pat Bates, the state senate in the 36th state senate district. One of the things that I think the key on here is that these candidates weren't very strong. Dana Rohrabacher, this guy got hit by a truck, and also they did not engage. To some degree, the GOP has had it comfortable here in Orange County for years, where they could just have a conversation amongst themselves. That is very much over.
Mimi Walters, a great example. She's just missing in action during the campaign. Very few appearances. And that allowed Katie Porter to, you know, she was everywhere when Mimi Walters was, not present. And now in the vote tabulation, Porter has taken the lead over Walters, the incumbent. This is a district. To think about that district going Democratic is just, particularly when Newport Beach was a part of that district, it's just absolutely shocking. But I wonder, Norberto, looking at the future, if you don't have such an energized Democratic electorate as you had this time, you don't have millions of dollars coming in from the DCCC and other Democratic groups, is it maybe a little different, two or four years from now?
It could be. You're absolutely right. You had a record amount of spending come in from the Democratic Campaign Congressional Committee. And the question is, will that maintain? However, the local party here, the local Democratic Party, definitely got a boost in the arm. They have a network now, and a good place to look at it is in places like Costa Mesa, where the entire city council shifted to Democrats. And I don't mean just a few. The entire city council in the 74th State Assembly race, Matt Harper, the incumbent there, lost as well. That place was completely a rout for Democrats. I do think that's where they will have now an institutional capability. But as you said, Larry, that's the big question for them is, can they keep up that kind of fundraising pace, and can they stay disciplined all the way through and put an agenda out?
It's Norberto Santana, the voice of OC, nonprofit newsroom in Orange County. Let me share a couple of listener comments. You can also join us on the phone at 866-893-KPCC. Let us know your thoughts about the dramatic political shift in Orange County. Joaquin in South L.A. says, stop trying to make third parties happen. If there's any major shift in the electorate, one of the two parties will shift their position to capture that group. Professor Campbell, you want to respond to Joaquin's point?
I think I disagree with Joaquin. You might note just yesterday, the former Republican leader of the state assembly, Kristen Olson, came out with an article in Cal Matters. GOP is dead in California. A new way must rise. So perhaps Joaquin and I could agree in this one respect. If the GOP is dead, then you can have a third party. It just would call it a second party. And the reason why I'm of the view that it has to be a third party is that what we saw this time should not, in all likelihood, be replicated in 2 years' time. And success breeds success. When President Trump is at the top of the ticket, as opposed to simply urging people to vote Republican, the consequence that you've been describing and Mr. Arellano and Mr. Santana have been describing will replicate. So you'll have two cycles of Democratic success because the Republicans have been unable to separate themselves from a toxic label identified with our president.
B.B. Steve writes on the page, I believe the GOP is no longer the conservative GOP. It was prior to 2000, perhaps back to before 1995. The GOP en masse became the party of no. New started that conservative wave in the mid-90s, that 2008 through 2016, the dysfunction gridlock brought on by the party of no, over a decade of no hardcore conservative progress, is what begat Trump and what is now seen as his Trumpites. That's B.B. Steve writing on the page. Gustavo, your thoughts about, where this leads in the next 2 to 4 years? Because the flip side of this is even with huge outspending of Democrats over Republicans in Orange County, what might well be a record-setting turnout for a midterm House election, Democrats in some of these races just squeaking by. So, I mean, is it possible that some of these race seats could flip 2 to 4 years from now?
Absolutely. It's a precarious situation. And that's where the Democratic Party of Orange County has failed for years and years and years, is that they knew that they had no chance until they acted like they had no chance. They never bothered to create a farm system of candidates. Frankly, they're very lucky that they won with a roster of mostly, you know, of all of them were first-time candidates. Harley Ruda, Mike Levin down all the way in San Clemente, Katie Porter, and what the Republicans have to do. Yeah, all their whole congressional delegation was a bunch of jokes and losers. So what what I predict they're going to do, they're going to rearm with some of their, I don't want to say better candidates, at least people with a better track record. So again, I predict that at this point, the Republican Party in Orange County, they're left with old racist voters and Asian Americans. So now they're going to swing to the Asian American side and really try to get them. And Irvine, especially, Irvine has such a huge Asian American community that has proven apt at fundraising for themselves and getting Asian Americans elected. This election, the Irvine City Council is not going to have a Chinese American and a Persian American, except the Persian Americans are Democrats. So that's what I expect the Republicans to do.
Hey, Gustavo, I know you're a columnist and a firebrand. Do you want to rethink that old racist white people and Asian Americans, that's all that's left?
No, because I've been writing about Orange County as a reporter and a columnist for 17 years. Born and raised here in Orange County. We know the story.
And you've never, you've never met a white Republican conservative who's not racist.
Oh, here in Orange County, you'd be surprised. There's some good ones, of course. You know, it's funny. Like, okay, I'll take this back. Tom Tate, the outgoing mayor of Anaheim, he was a white, very conservative Republican. He definitely wasn't a racist. And far from it, he was actually one of the people who created district elections in Anaheim. So it's a broad generalization. Guess what? I'll stick to it.
All right. Gustavo Arellano, Los Angeles Times opinion columnist, former editor of the OC Weekly. Norberto Santana Jr., the publisher of the Voice of OC nonprofit newsroom. And Tom Campbell, professor of economics and law at Chapman University, multi-level office holder in California. Tom Campbell, want to come back to you. You want to respond to Gustavo and how he characterized Republicans?
Yes, I disagree. That was an unfair characterization and a sweeping one. And it's no more legitimate from the left than coming from the right. Having said that, I chose to leave the Republican Party after its nomination of President Donald Trump. A vibrant democracy requires an opposition that is capable of putting forward alternatives on substance, and not so directed towards separating us on the basis of racial identity. What I see for the future is a third party because of the Republicans' failure, but it would be a substantive one. For example, how do we take care of people who are unable to compete in the new economy? Well, retraining or incentives for business to do it or government to do it. That's a very important debate. And if all we are left with is the Democratic point of view, we won't necessarily get it.
Let's talk a little bit on the practical side, though. Steve Poizner, I think, you know, whether people voted for him or not, most people would agree, was a strong candidate for state insurance commissioner, former Republican, ran as a no-party preference, is apparently going to lose to Ricardo Lara, Democratic legislator. That's a case where, and he'd been the former insurance commissioner, it looks like he's coming up short. He was sort of touted as the hope for people trying to rebrand themselves. Isn't that a setback to what you're proposing?
I don't think so, because he was trying statewide. And what I've been proposing is individual assembly and state senate districts, which if they had a non-democratic candidate, so whether that's an independent or a third party candidate, could represent the value of another point of view. The difficulty that Steve Poizner encountered was a Democratic wave throughout the entire state, and it was running statewide. That, I think, however, will replicate statewide. So I'm not holding out a change at the statewide level. I am, however, saying that there's a distinct possibility, even a likelihood, of picking off one state Senate district, three assembly districts, which would be enough to deprive the Democratic Party of the two-thirds they need for tax increase. All right. Sacramento.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Tom Campbell, Norberto Santana Jr., Gustavo Arellano, as we talk about the dramatic political changes in Orange County. The two outstanding House races are trending Democratic. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I was particularly struck by this idea that Lyft and Uber have started a subscription model. So they have Lyft, for example, has an all-access plan. You pay just about $300 a month for 30 rides under $15. Then you get 5% off rides that don't fit that criteria. Uber just started last week offering a ride pass plan. It's about $15 a month, although here in L.A. it's $25. Of course, it costs more here, which lets you avoid surge pricing, which if you've got socked with the surge pricing, that is some sticker shock at some times of the day. But the question is this subscription model, is that really going to be the trend? Is there enough of a savings there? And is this going to shift the way the ride-sharing companies operate? You can share your thoughts at 866-893-KPCC. Maybe you've already been an early subscriber. What do you think about it? Let us know. With me is D.T. Srikant, who is reporter covering travel and transportation for The Goods, which is the consumer area of Vox. D.T., thank you for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So have either of the ride-sharing companies done any sort of a subscription experiment before?
So they've been kind of toying with the model and letting certain people try it and toggling with the numbers for a couple of years now, but this is the first time they've released something like this that is open to the public that people can purchase. So I think we'll start seeing soon whether this is something people are excited about and whether they see it as worth it.
Yeah, and I guess a lot depends, like with the surge pricing discount, a lot depends the times of day that people travel. And do these companies, to your knowledge, have good data on the surge pricing and how much of an impediment it potentially is for customers?
I would assume so, and I think the fact that it's $10 more in L.A. would definitely say so, that they know surge pricing in certain cities costs some people way more than others, and they're just trying to figure out what numbers seem like they will be a deal to their consumers. But, yeah, I think they definitely have the data on it, and I think that they're just trying to, you know, they're trying to capitalize on the fact that people hate surge pricing.
Yeah, there's the psychological barrier. It just rubs me the wrong way. I get it as a supply demand, but it still kind of rubs me the wrong way. Aditi, I know you're looking at this from a consumer standpoint, but from the driver's standpoint, have you heard from drivers who are potentially concerned this could impact their earnings?
I haven't, actually. That's a good question.
All right. Also with us is Robbie Kelman-Baxter, consultant with Peninsula Strategies, which focuses on membership and subscription models. She's also the author of The Membership Economy, Find Your Super Users, Master the Forever Transaction, and Build Recurring Revenue. Robbie, thank you for being with us. What are some of the challenges inherent for the company in experimenting with a subscription model?
Well, the biggest challenge that they face is cannibalization. What you don't want is for your best customers, your most active customers, to now switch to better pricing without driving in more engagement from your less active customers.
All right. And, I mean, in a case like this, could the drivers be the ones, I mean, if you've got super users who, in a sense, overuse, for lack of a better term, as subscribers, does that end up, you know, dinging the drivers?
Yeah, well, you know, when I look, I don't have any inside information, but when you look at how the drivers are paid and you look at this model where less money is coming in, I got to expect that the drivers are going to pay for this at least partially with lower fees coming from the companies.
All right. And what are examples of the subscription models that have worked? I realize transportation is a little bit different, but some sort of activity usage where it seems like it's a win-win.
Yeah, we're seeing it everywhere, actually. One example that's pretty current right now is the change in behavior that's being driven in the video game world. That, it used to be, or it still is, that you can buy a new game for about $60, but you can now subscribe through Xbox, through EA, Electronic Arts, through several of the gaming players at a fixed cost. So there's a question of, if you pay $100 a year, but, the game is $60 to buy one game, but now you have access to all games for $100. It's a great deal if you're currently buying two games. It might be a great deal if you're buying one game because now you get more games to play. But it really depends on how much you like to play to start with.
And it seems the initial pricing is a real challenge, because if you come in at kind of a loss leader price to get people to subscribe, and then you find it's too much of a loss and you're then raising your prices, then you have to deal with the negative relationship with your customers.
Exactly. It's really hard to raise the price of a subscription. And as Aditi pointed out, both of these companies have been playing with their pricing and doing very small experiments. Lyft's offer has landed at $300 for the 30 rides worth up to $15, but they experimented with $199 for the same thing. And they also experimented with $399 for double the number of rides, 60 rides a month. So the experimentation, I think, was to help them understand how much cannibalization there would be so that they didn't lower their price too much and then not be able to recover from that.
Yeah, I was going to say, boy, that super user, $600 a month. I mean, that's someone who really is only using, it would seem, the ride-hailing service as opposed to public transit or anything else.
Yeah, and I think that they're – yeah, sorry.
Sorry. Oh, I was going to say that's something they're trying to, it's probably what you're going to say, trying to align with. They say that this is a move toward making communities less vehicle dependent. So by aligning themselves with an environmental message, I think maybe they think that will push this subscription service farther. People believe that they are buying something that ultimately will do good for the environment. Perhaps that'll affect their decision to buy something that's a little out of their price range or maybe isn't a no-brainer financially.
I don't know. I mean, do you have any sense, Aditi, of how many people spend more than $600 on ride-hailing services?
I don't. We have in the article that in major cities in Los Angeles, apparently people spend 64 on Uber and 48 on Lyft per month. In cities like New York, it says an average of 84 on Uber and 54 on Lyft per month. So these prices do seem wild to me.
They're super user, so to speak, prices. Aditi Srikant joining us from the Vox Transportation and Travel Beat, known as The Goods. Robbie Kelman-Baxter, consultant, Peninsula Strategies, and an expert on membership and subscription models. Robbie, what about, autonomous vehicles? They may be well off into the future, but you think the subscription model would work there?
Yeah, absolutely. And Waymo just announced that they're going to be starting in Texas with real rides with real real passengers next year. So it has the extra benefit of not having to talk to the driver, which I think a lot of people will prefer.
But do you tip the AI in the car?
Yeah, it's funny. You're asking about examples. The car wash industry, one of the things I found really surprising there, they've introduced subscription pricing pretty widely now, that if you pay about the cost of two car washes or three car washes a month, you get unlimited car washes. One of the things that they found that surprised them was that some people were subscribing to the car wash service just so that they could use their swipe card and not have to talk to the attendant.
How interesting. Wow. Hey, thank you, Robbie. All kinds of really good information. Robbie Kelman-Baxter, Peninsula Strategies. Aditi Srikant joining us from Vox's The Goods. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. It's wonderful to have you with us.